So when I first saw this from Maya Angelou, it resonated so much, you know, because I felt that she had explicitly stated in words the feeling that was pervasive in my life and many other people's lives that I interact with professionally as people of color. When you talk about dueling consciousness, you talk about wearing a mask, and that my daughter goes to a school in which she's the only African-American child. I have teachers talk to me in a way that I know they don't talk to other people. And yet I have to put on a mask and smile and try to be as polite as possible because my child is the one that's in that environment, not me. That when I want her to have interactions with kids here, even though I get from parents sometimes that want to touch my hair or want to tell me about the one Black person they knew or want to tell me about why they feel that, you know, Blacks shouldn't be so sensitive, as they put it. I have to keep the smile on my face because I'm doing it for my child. And so it's a mask that I pull over that does not get to get taken off until I'm home in the sanctuary of my home or around people that understand that which I deal with on a daily basis. When you looked at Maya Angelou on there, she had a smile on her face, but the pain was in her eyes. And I think that's very difficult to understand when you can choose whether or not to deal with that. Honestly, and you know, if I was in a position of power, I would like to think that I'd be one who would still be empathetic and sympathetic to those people who needed help, who I should be allies to. I can say for sure, I like to think that I'd be that way. When I went to Afghanistan, I went there as a linguist, and I also went there as a contracting officer, which meant that I interacted primarily with Afghanis, and my office was outside of the base. And often I would have to correct soldiers because they would be disrespectful to these people whose home we were intruding upon. And they say, well, you know, they should be happy we're here. We're helping them out. We're teaching them something. They would say this about men who are old enough to be their grandfathers. They would say this about men who have been generals in their army. And these 18 and 19 year old kids would come with an attitude that they should be happy we're here, that we're teaching them something, that without our presence, they wouldn't be able to progress. And so I would have to correct them, which was not popular and did not endear me to a lot of people because they felt like I should have kept my mouth closed. But I felt that I could have done that and I wouldn't have suffered any repercussions, but then I couldn't face myself when I went to look in the mirror. Because ultimately what I do know is that I'm a person of integrity. And I'm a person that, if at all possible, I try to do the right thing by myself and others. And so when I was thinking about, you know, examples, and I said, many of you have tasted an orange, right? You probably tasted 100, 200 oranges in your lifetime. And because you've tasted so many oranges, you have a varied perspective from whence to give an opinion on an orange. You can say, well, sometimes they're sweet, sometimes they're sour, sometimes they're in season. If they're in season, they're like this. Sometimes they have seeds, sometimes they're seedless. We have the cuties oranges, we have, you know, the larger oranges. And so you can give, right, a varied kind of explanation of what it is to eat an orange. But then let's go to caviar, for example, and probably many of you have not tasted caviar, or if you have, you tasted it maybe once. And so if you've had a bad experience with that caviar, that has then colored your whole experience of what caviar is. You can say with oranges, this is the scope. But with caviar, oh no, it's not good because you've had that one experience. And so the same is often true when I ask people and I say, well, how many people of color are you actually interacting with on a daily basis? Who's in your community, your neighborhood? Who are your friends? Who comes to your house for dinner? Who do you vacation with? And I find people of color to be few and far between. And then I ask them, well, how do you give an opinion about a whole group of people when essentially you've had one interaction. You will hear people say African-Americans are like this, Latinos are like that. And then you ask, well, how many do you know? Well, not many, but the ones that I do know. So that one, that two, that three were an example of a whole group of people. It's very easy to look at and say, you know, white people are like this because you see it on the news. You see what happened with the Capitol. You see the response to Black Lives Matter coming versus this other group. You saw it right there on the screen. And the way they responded, because we don't really know Black people. What we do know is that they're violent. How do you know that? Well, the one person I saw, they were violent. So because that one person was a representation for that whole group, this is the course of action we're going to take. Well, you have these other people that literally stated they were going to commit violence, that posted about it openly. They came there with violence, but I knew them. I felt like I could talk to them. So my reaction was different. And so when it comes to the dueling consciousness, it's that ever-present understanding that the way you are going to be interpreted in most cases is going to be as an alien, as someone who is not familiar. So you try to present yourself in a way that is not antagonistic, that's not threatening, because you want this other person who you deem to have the power to feel comfortable with your presence. That is a hard place to be in. And for many, they get to the point where they just can't handle anymore and they just kind of leave. African-American women are the highest educated and the number one entrepreneurs. And you'll find that in many cases, when you talk about them, it's because they had to leave the corporate environment because it was not open to them. It was a hostile environment. So when we go on to empathy, I was talking to my adoptive mom, Bobby, and I put the question in your packets about being late. And I got some responses via email, and from taking a little survey, it seems that many people thought that, you know, you should be on time. Being late was disrespectful, that it said about, you know, that person that they were unorganized, or that they were being rude. And Bobby and I had this conversation, and I said, that's your perception, right? And she said, well, no, that's the way it is. And I said, well, that's the way it is here in America. But if you go into many other cultures, that is not the way it is. Time is very lax. It's not, we're going to be here at 5. It's an understanding that if it's 5 o'clock, some people may show up at 5:30. Some people may show up at 6. It is very rude actually to show up at 5 o'clock. So this concept of time and being on time is not a worldly concept. It is simply a westernized way of thought. And when you look at Western thought, you look at who put that in place. And there's a term, you can't use this, please don't go out and say this, but it's a term called CP time. You may have heard of it. If you haven't, it's kind of one of those things that's behind the mask. So please don't go to like a person of color and be like, hey, I heard about CP time, because I'm giving you some secrets right here. So it's called CP time, which stands for Colored People Time or Caribbean Time. And what that means is in many cases, for a person of color, especially African-American person, if you say 2 o'clock, they're probably showing up at 2:15 or 2:30. And we call it CP time. It's a kind of funny thing in the culture, right? And you look at that and you're like, well, why can't they just be on time? Well, let's look at the history of African-Americans in America. During slavery times, their time was not their own, right? 6 days out of the week, they worked from sun up to sundown. They were told when they could eat, when they could sleep, when they could spend time with their families. Then you look at when the slaves were emancipated, right? And then most of them were domestic workers, or they still had to work in Jim Crow society. So they were still told what they could do with their time. And that if you were hired to be a housekeeper, it came 5 o'clock, you couldn't say, it's 5 o'clock, I get to go home. You were able to go home when you were released. So your time was not your own. And so amongst the people came an understanding that time was not so vital, but space was. That we couldn't say 4 o'clock because we didn't know when they would be let go. but we could say we were gathering. And so we became appreciative of the fact that simply someone was able to be there rather than a stickler about what time they got there. Because to do that was to bring up the fact that their time was not their own. So you come from different two different worldviews. One in which for this group of people that were able to set the time and set the schedule, timeliness is a huge thing. But for another group of people in which their history was that time was never theirs to allocate, space in the bigger picture and time receded in the background. So you have two people coming for a meeting, for example, and they say 2 o'clock and say you and I meet and I show up at 2:17 and you're kind of aggravated because you felt like it was 2 o'clock and I'm feeling like I'm giving you space. So then we come to a place where there's already a conflict because you come from this understanding and I come from this one. And what Bobby said to me is she said, yes, but you know, it just keeps things organized. Everybody is on time. And I said, well, other countries are organized. They really are. They get things done too. They're a lot less anxious as well. And she said, well, that doesn't matter. It's just, you know, it's the way it is here in America and we just need to follow it. I said, that's the problem right there. That's a slippery slope. Because if you put that argument in place that this is the way things are set in place and you need to just follow it, we can do that for a whole bunch of stuff. The problem is not understanding that parties did not come into play and get to establish what the standard is. That maybe the perception that you have is because you got to set the standard and that you did it without the input of other groups that want to exist in the same space. So in this chapter, he's talking about how they set things in motion as far as black on black crime, as far as people feeling that education was the way to progress, feeling that those who committed crimes were going against our race, this idea that they were making us look bad as though we were one body, one group of people, because again, we're the caviar, right? And so to this other group that has power, they don't know how to experience us. So when one person commits a crime, we're just like, they're a bad reflection on all of us because we know that they don't see us as the oranges. We know they don't have experience with us and we need you to act right because we're trying to progress ourselves as a people. So when you mess up for all of us. That is a big weight to carry. And the breakout groups that you're going to have, there are two questions I think that would be good to focus on. In explaining kind of the time thing, I want you to think about a situation in which you felt, and this is the first question on page one, in which you acted in a certain way or you had a certain thought. And through the lens now of dueling consciousness, of maybe understanding that maybe your perception was yours and that it wasn't right or wrong, but it was merely your experience. What is a situation that you might change now or a thought process that you might put into place that's different from what you had before? And the second question that I think would be good to focus on, I'm sorry, that question right there was on page 5 at the top. On page 4, I put the excerpt from Dubois. At the top, he says about double consciousness, about the sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others. What do you think that experience would be like if you ever gone to a foreign country in which your customs, your way of being was completely foreign to those people and they probably thought you were crazy or probably just one of those, you know, Americans? What was that experience like for you? And then we'll come back.